This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, everyone. This is Marta Bowling, and these are Wall Street Journal editorials for the week ended Saturday, April 27th. There's a lot of interesting articles this week. The first, for those of you men who think about the Roman Empire every day, there is a book review of Populus by Guy de la Bediera, written by James Rahm, who is a professor at Bard. Is there any dish more Roman than Trojan pig? It consists of a whole roast pig, its body cavity stuffed with smaller roasts, just as the Trojan horse was filled with men. With its suggestion of superabundance and its ironic use of classical myth, the Trojan pig seems emblematic of the High Roman Empire, a time when the foods of three continents burgeoned on rich men's tables, and among the literate, the snarky poems of satirists like Juvenal and Martial were all the rage. For modern readers, those poems are a treasure trove of factoids like the Trojan pig. And spoofing the pretensions of their peers, the satirists observe the world around them in keen detail, recording and often exaggerating its bizarre affectations. It's difficult not to write satire, said Juvenal of the times in which he lived, the late first and early second centuries. He found huge amusement and much to disdain in the quirks and foibles of life on the river Tiber. Juvenal is singled out for special mention by the British author and broadcaster Guy de la Bediera in the introduction to Populus, his diverting survey of the ancient Roman social and physical landscape. He and others like him, writes Mr. de la Bediera of Juvenal, have played such an important role in handing down everyday vignettes of life in the Rome of his time, providing us with the words and color to populate the empty ruins. Populus draws on such archives as the Quotidian to make ancient Rome seem both wonderfully weird and convincingly real. And not only Rome, but also its harbor town Ostia and the two Italian cities destroyed by volcanic eruption, Pompeii and Herculaneum. Trained as an archaeologist, Mr. de la Bediera makes use of those sites more thoroughly excavated than elsewhere to fill out the picture he gleams from written sources. An avid numismatist, he takes special interest in evidence from coins, especially in his discussion of Roman counterfeiting. Who knew that fake demari could be created by molding thin sheets of silver to take the impression from the faces of actual coins and then soldering them together over a core of base metal? Populus abounds in such peaks beneath the surface of official Rome. Consider the puncti, or puncturers, water suppliers who set up illicit diversions from Rome's water pipes to serve paying customers, or aqueduct workers who skimmed off water for sale as today's black marketeers might, and skim off oil. During the first century, such depredations slowed the supply to public fountains and facilities to almost nil, writes Mr. de la Bediera. Beyond his interest in ruins and coins, Mr. de la Bediera has a knack for finding interesting people, not the great figures of history, but common folk, even slaves. Aulus Umbrus Scaurus was once a slave, then a freedman, who ran a Pompeii business producing garum, a sauce made from fermented fish. The wide distribution of pottery fragments from jars that once held this sauce, some of them marked optimum, meaning best, attest to his success. His house, discovered in western Pompeii, was adorned with mosaics depicting similar jars bearing similar slogans. This proud entrepreneur clearly wanted visitors to notice his products. Another populist figure who rose from humble roots was Lucius Aurelius Apollostus Memphius, renamed as an adult to honor the two co-emperors of his day, Lucius Verus and Marcus Aurelius, and to advertise the pleasure he gave with his dance performances. A Syrian and a slave by birth, he caught the eye of Emperor Verus and was brought to Rome, set free, and granted citizenship. He won acclaim for his exposition in Dance of Pythagoras philosophy of the transmigration of souls, surely something not to be missed. Mr. de la Bediera tells us, without explanation, that this stellar performer was killed by Emperor Commodus after the dancer's patron, Verus, was gone from the scene. Populus takes special interest in commoners, but no Roman miscellany would be complete without a few imperial escapades. Caligula is here seen providing his favorite horse, Incitatus, with its own house and staff of slaves, but not apparently the office of consul. The book specifies that, contrary to popular belief, the mad monarch said only that he planned to put his horse in that high post. Claudius, to our astonishment, goes on a whale hunt when an orca, attracted by a spilled shipload of hides, gets trapped in the harbor in Ostia. He succeeds in having the animal speared to death, but the spoon from the dying whale's blowhole sinks one of the emperor's boats, a seeming impossibility, yet Pliny the Elder, the naturalist who records it, claims to have been an eyewitness. Like Mr. De La Bediera's earlier Gladius, The World of a Roman Soldier, 2020, Populus organizes its topics thematically rather than chronologically. In chapters that deal with family life, slavery, medicine, sex, and the like, items of interest are spread out before us in no particular sequence, selected from various segments of Rome's timeline. This ahistorical treatment works well enough, but occasionally causes distortions. In his opening chapter, Cityscape, which deals with the physical layout of Rome, one finds no mention of the Great Fire of AD 64 and the intense building programs that followed. A non-linear cabinet of curiosities approach has grown increasingly widespread of late in books on the ancient world. A long-running series published by Oxford uses the phrase in its titles, A Cabinet of Greek Curiosities, etc. Such collections are easy to dip into, but don't lend themselves to immersive reading in the way that connective narratives do. They can feel like snacking rather than eating a solid meal, though, of course, some meals can be so heavy as to rival the Trojan pig. If Populus works best as a smorgasbord, it's an appealing one indeed. With his wide array of sources, his eye for compelling details, and his engaging prose style, Mr. De La Bediera keeps the reader eager for more and wondering what strange fact about Roman life will be served up next. That was Populus by Guy De La Bediera. A letter to the editor on the Ninth Circuit leaving the homeless worse off. This is by Tom O'Hare, PhD from Boston College School of Social Work. The editorial board is right that the Ninth Circuit extension of the logic of Robinson versus California in 1962 is causing enormous real-world harm. People living on the street have severe problems, including mental illness and addiction, but they are committing crimes by living on public and sometimes private property, using drugs, defecating in doorways, and harassing passersby. A meaningful approach to this problem would give the homeless a choice, prison or treatment. If they choose treatment, they'll get medical attention, including medication and detox, get nourished and cleaned up, set up in low-income housing, and, when capable, a job in addition to public assistance. Monitoring and check-ins by social workers, however, must continue with the proviso that if people relapse, then they are faced with the original contingency of jail or rehab. It often takes a few go-rounds before folks get straight and become productive citizens living with dignity. Leaving people to rot on the streets is the opposite of compassionate social justice and a perverse approach to the protection of civil rights. We all can see the results in the current failed policy. From the editorial board, Jack Smith's Bad Immunity Day. Special counsel Jack Smith should have been reading our contributor David Rivkin. If he'd been reading these pages, he might have foreseen Thursday's oral argument at the Supreme Court before he indicted Donald Trump. Instead, the argument was a legal defeat for him and the Justice Department that could delay his prosecution past the November election. Ms. Michael Dreeben, the Biden counsel, told the justices that Mr. Trump and any other president deserve no immunity from criminal prosecution, but he ran into a skeptical set of justices focused not on Mr. Trump's case, but on the implications of the Dreeben-Smith position for the office of the presidency. "I'm not concerned about this case," said Justice Neil Gorsuch. "I am concerned about future uses of criminal law to target political opponents based on accusations about their motives." He added that, "We're writing a rule for the ages." Justice Brett Kavanaugh offered a similar concern about the future impact of prosecutions on presidential decision-making on controversial subjects. Mr. Dreeben's reply was to suggest that this isn't a problem because prosecutors don't bring cases when there isn't sufficient evidence for a conviction. He also said a president gets good legal advice from the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel about what official acts are legal, so no president would commit such a crime. The justices made short work of that one, with Justice Samuel Alito reminding Mr. Dreeben that two attorneys general were convicted of crimes and how easy it is for a prosecutor to cajole a grand jury to indict someone. Chief Justice John Roberts was especially scathing about the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that a president has no immunity. That opinion argued, and Mr. Dreeben defended it, that a former president can be prosecuted because he's being prosecuted, said the chief. This ignores that presidents have special obligations and must make decisions that set them apart from any federal official, much less an average citizen. Oral arguments aren't always a signal of a future ruling, but it sounds as if a majority is prepared to find that Mr. Trump is immune from prosecution for actions that are part of his official duties. The key, then, is distinguishing between official and private actions, and the justices may send the case back to trial court to consider the facts regarding the charges and evidence against Mr. Trump. The press ignored nearly all of this in the run-up to the oral argument, with many calling Mr. Trump's claim absurd. Credit to the justices for an educational hearing that focused on the right questions for the presidency, the separation of powers, and the country. Some anti-Israel protesters are paid. This is by Ira Stoll, who writes for TheEditors.com. Since at least the Vietnam War, exasperated observers of student protests have rolled their eyes and thought, get a job. In some cases today, activism is a job. Two of America's largest philanthropic foundations are behind a group that has paid some of the anti-Israel activists for the kind of antics disrupting campuses across the country. Consider Malak Afana, a law student at the University of California, Berkeley, and Craig Burkhead Morton, a senior at Yale. Ms. Afana went viral this month for disrupting a dinner at Dean Erwin Chemerinsky's home. This week, the Yale Daily News reported that Mr. Burkhead Morton had been arrested for trespassing and then reemerged to address an anti-Israel crowd blocking an intersection in New Haven. Ms. Afana and Mr. Burkhead Morton have both been youth fellows of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, whose website identifies them by their first names. As of April 4th, the campaign was soliciting applications for a new cohort whose campus-based fellows would receive stipends for three-month terms of roughly 8 hours of work a week. That work could include aiding campaigns that demand federal or state politicians cut U.S. military, financial, or diplomatic ties with Israel. The corporate entity behind these fellowships is Education for Just Peace in the Middle East. Where does it get its funding? George and Alexander Soros's Open Society Foundation has put $700,000 into Education for Just Peace in the Middle East since 2018. Most recently, with a two-year grant in 2022, according to the Open Society Foundation's website, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund has given Education for Just Peace in the Middle East $515,000 since 2019, most recently with a three-year grant for $225,000 awarded in 2023. While some policymakers have wondered whether activists receive money from overseas, it turns out there's a clear paper trail of funding at home. That ought to have policy implications. In considering whether to discipline students for rule violations, university administrators might more harshly punish activism done at least in part for pay. Do the Rockefeller and Soros families want their money to be used to advocate for Hamas's war aims? They should consider that themselves. Meantime, Congress and the Internal Revenue Service might want to examine whether the grants fit the charitable purpose defined in the tax code. The media says crime is going down, but don't believe it. This is by John Lott Jr., who is president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. Americans think crime is on the rise, but the media keep telling them they're wrong. A Gallup survey last year found that 92% of Republicans and 58% of Democrats thought crime was increasing. A February Rasmussen report survey found that 61% of likely voters say violent crime in the U.S. is getting worse, while only 13% think it's getting better. Journalists purport to refute this by citing official crime statistics that show a downward trend. Americans aren't mistaken. News reports fail to take into account that many victims aren't reporting crimes to the police, especially since the pandemic. The U.S. has two measures of crime. The Federal Bureau of Investigation's Uniform Crime Reporting Program counts the number of crimes reported to police every year. The Bureau of Justice Statistics, in its National Crime Victimization Survey, asks 240,000 people a year whether they have been victim of a crime. The two measures have diverged since 2020. The FBI has been reporting less crime, while more people say they have been victims. The divergence is due to several reasons. In 2022, 31% of police departments nationwide, including Los Angeles and New York, didn't report crime data to the FBI. In addition, in cities from Baltimore to Nashville, Tennessee, the FBI is undercounting crimes those jurisdictions reported. Another reason crimes reported to police are falling is that arrest rates are plummeting. If victims don't believe criminals will be caught and punished, they won't bother reporting them. According to the FBI, if you take the 5 years preceding COVID, 2015 to 2019, and compare them with 2022, the percentage of violent crimes in all cities resulting in an arrest fell from 44% to 35%, and among cities with more than a million people, which have disproportionately more crime, arrest rates are over the same period plunged from 44% to 20%. Arrests for property crimes dived even more sharply. FBI data show that in 2022, 12% of reported property crimes in all cities resulted in an arrest. In cities of more than a million people, only 4.5% of reported property crimes in 2022 resulted in an arrest. Based on the National Crime Victimization Survey, only 42% of violent crimes, such as robberies or aggravated assaults, and 32% of property crimes, such as burglary and arson, were reported in 2022. While the Justice Department doesn't track the number of prosecutions, the percentage of arrests that resulted in prosecution appears to have fallen that year as well. In large cities, the arrest rate in 2022 compared with 2015 through 19 averages fell 38% for murders, 50% for rapes, 55% for aggravated assault, and 58% for robberies. That's the falling arrest rate. While the rate of reported violent crime fell 2.1% between 2021 and 2022, the National Crime Victimization Survey shows that total violent crime reported and non-reported rose from 16.5 incidents to 23.5 per 1,000 people. Non-reported violent crime in 2022 exceeded the 2015 through 19 average by more than 17%. Data reflect the scant consequences criminals face. During 2022, in cities with more than a million people, only 8.4% of all violent crimes and reported and unreported, and 1.4% of all property crimes resulted in an arrest. Not all those arrests resulted in charges. Initial estimates cited by some news organizations show murder rates dropping 13% between 2022 and 2023. Murders usually are reported, so they don't have the same reporting flaws as other violent crimes, yet last year's projected murder rate was still 5.51 per 100,000 people, or 7% above the 2019 level. Law enforcement has collapsed in the U.S., particularly in big cities, with many Americans no longer confident that the legal system will protect them. Some 22 million now have concealed handgun permits. 29 states have adopted constitutional carry laws that allow citizens to carry a firearm without a permit. A Crime Prevention Research Center survey last year found that 15.6% of general election voters carry concealed handguns all or most of the time. That's three times the level found in a 2017 Pew Research Center survey. A recent Rasmussen report survey found that not everyone sees violent crime on the rise. Less than half of likely voters who earn more than $200,000 a year think that it's getting worse, yet a majority of all other income groups disagree. People of both sexes and every race think crime is getting worse. It isn't surprising that affluent people can insulate themselves from spikes in crime, but that doesn't mean it isn't happening. Americans aren't simply imagining that our streets have become more dangerous. Gid and Man on My iPhone. This is by Jim Towey, who is founder of the nonprofit Aging with Dignity and the author of To Love and Be Loved, A Personal Portrait of Mother Teresa. I was finishing a text message when I accidentally typed Gid bless you. Rather than fix the typo by inserting God, my iPhone underlined the errant word in red and offered me three corrections: giddy, did, and kid. You know, as in giddy bless you, or how in did's name did that happen, or kid bless America. Apple can't be expected to wade into the minutiae of every message, but how could it exclude the obvious option from the list of fixes? Microsoft Outlook approaches the GID problem more inclusively. It proposed remedies of GAD, God, Guide, Guild, and GERD. I'm not sure how guide, spelled G-I-D-E, made the list since it isn't a word, but I do understand why guild did. Its secondary definition, according to Merriam-Webster, is to give an attractive but often deceptive appearance to something, which is what Microsoft did when it gilded its list with God. This experience piqued my interest. When I mistyped another deity, Taylor Swift, my iPhone offered the correct spelling of her proper name. Yet when I spelled it correctly and recast her 2019 hit as false GID, the device asked whether I meant to write gods. That's a step up from giddy, even if a bit pantheistic. For the record, I wish Ms. Swift had named her song False Giddy, a more apt description of her behavior at the Kansas City Chiefs suite whenever her beau Travis Kelce scored a touchdown, but I digress. If Apple couldn't recognize God, what about Lucifer, ruler of hell in Dante's Inferno? I typed Lucifer, and my phone instantly corrected the spelling. No questions asked. Can't blame Apple for not wanting to play with fire. I then did what anyone proficient in 21st century tech would do in time of trouble. I checked out the emojis. If you search for God, you only get a palette of paint. If you search for devil, you get four choices, two purple and two red. Curiously, angel gets you only three, and an angelfish. I'm Catholic, so I wanted to consult the choices for priest, nun, and pope. That evidently stumped the design team, which must have been too busy creating a mermaid, merman, witch, warlock, and three vampires. Same if you searched for Jesus Christ or Virgin Mary, two figures artists have depicted for centuries. When you ask for a rosary, you get only a string of red prayer beads representing an Islamic Mizbaha or Buddhist mala. My Jewish friends looking for emoji love don't fare any better. Rabbi and yarmulke are ignored. Credit Apple for its chutzpah. Search hijab, however, and you get a woman wearing one. Enter turban, and you get three options. All this may make one wonder whether big tech has an agenda. Google is doing penance for the blatant bias in its Gemini artificial intelligence model that presented historically inaccurate but racially diverse images. Is Apple trying to diminish Judeo-Christian beliefs? Perhaps, but better to give the engineers the benefit of the doubt. God is their judge. Gid, not so much. Who pays corporate taxes? Look in the mirror. This is by Phil Graham and Mike Solon. In his call for Congress to repeal the 2017 tax cuts and increase corporate tax rates, President Biden asked, "Are we going to continue with an economy where the overwhelming share of the benefits go to big corporations and the very wealthy?" Representative Richard Neal, ranking Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee, said that extending the tax cuts will do nothing but fill the pockets of venture capitalists and some business owners. President Obama's top economist, Austin Goolsbee, said that debates over who pays the corporate tax are an argument about whether making corporations pay more income taxes would trickle down to lower workers' wages. But as John Adams once said, facts are stubborn things. 70 years into the weakest recovery in post-war history, as the economy slumped towards a recession, The 2017 tax cuts and the Trump administration's regulatory relief sent real median household income soaring by $5,220 in 2019. That's 49% higher than the previous highest annual gain in 2015 and 11 times higher than the average percentage gain over the previous 50 years. Real median income rose more in inflated adjusted dollars in 2019 alone than during the entire Obama recovery from 2009 through 16. The poverty level plunged at the fastest rate since 1966 to the lowest level since the Census Bureau started collecting the data in 1959. The lowest income quintile saw its average real income rise by 9.4% in 2019, the year after the tax cut took effect. Since the Census Bureau doesn't count refundable tax credits as income for the recipients or count the effect of any other tax change in measuring household income, none of these income gains and poverty reductions had anything to do with the increased child tax credit. Economic growth was entirely responsible. It's still a free country, and critics can say whatever they want about the 2017 tax cuts, knowing the mainstream media will let them get away with it. But they can't change the facts. No federal spending or tax policy change in the past 50 years was followed by as large an increase in real median household income or as big a drop in the poverty rate as the Trump tax cuts. Everyone expected that the owners of American public companies would benefit, and they did. The stock market surged in 2017 in anticipation of the tax cuts and in 2018 and 19 in response to them. Who owns American corporations? According to tax notes, 72% of the value of all domestically held stocks is owned by pension plans, 401ks, IRAs, and charitable organizations, or held by life insurance companies to fund annuities and death benefits. Corporate tax rates, which were the driving force behind the permanent part of the 2017 tax cuts, receive less attention than individual income tax rates only because Americans don't understand that corporations don't pay taxes. A corporate entity is a pass-through legal structure, a piece of paper in a Delaware filing cabinet. When corporate tax rate increases, corporations try to pass the cost on to consumers. To the degree that the entire cost of the tax increase can't be passed on to consumers, those costs are borne by employees and investors. Most economic studies conclude that 50 to 70% of a corporate tax increase not passed on in higher prices is borne by workers, while 30 to 50% is borne by investors. If you consume, you pay the corporate tax. If you consume and work for a corporation, you pay the corporate tax twice. If you consume, work, and invest your retirement funds in corporate equities, the corporate tax rate hits you three times. Democrats call up the image of the greedy robber baron as the personification of big corporations, but when you pull back the curtain, it isn't the wizard or the robber baron you see, but yourself as a consumer, worker, and pensioner. Many Americans don't pay individual income taxes, but all Americans pay corporate taxes. In fact, a recent Treasury study confirms that 92.6 million families, 49.5% of all American families, pay more in corporate taxes than they do in individual income taxes. Unfortunately, Americans consistently underappreciate the burden the corporate income tax imposes, especially on middle and low-income Americans. President Biden's proposed corporate tax increases would raise taxes on more low and moderate income American families than if he raised individual income tax rates. Congress should reject Mr. Biden's efforts to raise corporate tax rates, especially his effort to circumvent Congress and the Constitution with a global minimum corporate tax. If Congress refuses to adopt the global minimum corporate tax, Mr. Biden would allow foreign countries to tax U.S. subsidiaries to collect the equivalent of the global minimum tax on their U.S. earnings. Congress should pass a joint resolution rejecting the global minimum corporate tax. Further, it should adopt legislation that mandates retaliation against any country trying to tax American subsidiaries to collect the corporate minimum tax on U.S. earnings. Mr. Biden and congressional Democrats claim corporations that get tax subsidies don't pay their fair share, but the entire Biden program is festooned with special interest corporate subsidies. We should eliminate those subsidies and use the savings to reduce corporate tax rates. We must never forget that the corporate tax is a tax on everything we buy, a tax on our wages, and a tax on our retirement nest eggs. By taxing corporations, the Democrats are taxing the American people. Now, here's another bookshelf, a review of A Travel Guide to the Middle Ages by Anthony Bale, and it's written by Alan Massey, the author of The Royal Stuarts, A History of the Family That Shaped Britain. One thinks of the Middle Ages as a time when peasants rarely moved more than a few miles from their huts, or monks from their monasteries, when people generally, other than perhaps the well-to-do, were rooted in place for lack of means or motivation. But this was not the case. A Travel Guide to the Middle Ages, Anthony Bale describes a variety of medieval commoners taking long journeys on foot and horseback and by ship. They traveled as soldiers, pilgrims, and traders, and sometimes found themselves in distant lands, not least the Holy Land. There is, Mr. Bale writes, only occasional evidence in medieval Europe of wanderlust, of people wanting to travel for its own sake. Yet there were exceptions, such as wandering minstrels and students. Pilgrims were the most numerous travelers. In the Middle Ages, Mr. Bale says, though not all their journeys were long, Chaucer's pilgrims in the Canterbury Tales went only from London to Canterbury, about 60 miles. That particular journey reads like a holiday, but other pilgrimages were more arduous. Curiosity, no doubt, played a part, but men and women traveled to holy sites to save their souls. It was a serious business. Among their destinations were Rome, of course, as well as Aachen and Cologne in Germany and Santiago de Compostela in Spain. And then there was Jerusalem. The English mystic Marjorie Kemp, a mother of 14, traveled there between 1413-1414, weeping for her own sins and other people's too. Along the way, she worried about brigands and, as Mr. Bale puts it, rape and sexual harassment by strangers. The Jerusalem she arrived at was then controlled by the Mamluk Turks and their sultanate, which had expelled the Christian crusaders 2 centuries before her journey. Most pilgrims who were headed to the Holy Land went first to Venice, the great sea power of the Mediterranean. Travelers were overawed by its wealth and beauty and astonished by its management of their expeditions. The name of every visitor was recorded, and lodgings were arranged, some luxurious, others wretched. Quarantine islands were designated from travelers suffering from the Black Plague. In Venice, travelers could change money and buy provisions for onward travel. Even so, they might have to wait for months at the mercy of ship captains and the weather. The dangers and hardships of the voyage when it began make even today's extreme tourism seem safe and comfortable. The journey from Venice to the Holy Land might take 6 weeks. Since ships called at several ports on the way to Anatolia, at Rhodes and Cyprus, for instance, life was no easier when at last a traveler reached the Holy Land. Though the Mamluks admired the pilgrim tourists, they resented them too, often fleecing them. As in Venice, administrative rigor was evidenced in Jerusalem, with the names of visitors being logged into the efficient machinery of the Mamluk government. Mr. Bale writes, many holy sites were in poor repair, and pilgrims could be roughly handled. Still, the Franciscan order provided guides, and pilgrims walked in the steps of Christ's Passion. Many chipped bits of stone from the holy places, fragments to be treated with great devotion, and on being brought home, says Mr. Bale, placed among the chief relics of churches. They were obviously more than mere souvenirs, though that too. As Mr. Bale reminds us, people ventured beyond Europe in the Holy Land. Merchants followed the Silk Roads, for there was more than one, traveled through the steppe lands of Central Asia and the vast Mongol states or empires as far as China. Marco Polo, traveling in the 13th century, is the best known, though not one of Mr. Bale's favorites. The voluble, if pedantic, prosaic, and unreliable Venetian merchant. Traveling merchants were catered to in caravanserais, the medieval equivalent of roadhouses or motels, welcome if also dangerous. The exotic nature of such travel led to alarming stories of hazard and danger. For instance, Tales of the Old Man of the Mountain and His Band of Assassins, a myth grounded in the life of an 11th century religious leader in Persia, but then elaborated fantastically until the myth came to supplant the historic reality. As Mr. Bale writes, reality was marvelous enough. Nowhere more so than the city we now know as Beijing, ruled by a Mongol dynasty well into the 14th century. According to the reports brought back to the West, the city was, Mr. Bale says, the matchless expression of the great Khan's power and wealth, technological sophistication, and love of ordered beauty. There was nothing to compare to it in Europe, not even Venice. If civilization flourished in the East, the West, before too long, was spreading its wings, or rather, its sails. By the end of the 15th century, the first glimmerings of European empires were discernible. There was much ignorance, of course. Europeans still had little knowledge of, for instance, Japan, and their sense of Africa was speculative, to say the least. Their knowledge of lands across the Atlantic was sparse, but would famously improve. Part of the appeal of a travel guide to the Middle Ages is its tendency to ramble, like more than a few of the journeys it records. Mr. Bale, a professor of medieval studies at the University of London, moves to and fro in time as well as in geographical space. He dips into the accounts of a wide range of travelers whose adventures are often compelling, but whose reliability can't always be counted on. Someone calling himself Sir John Mandeville in the late 14th century produced The Travels of John Mandeville, a popular chronicle written with assumed authority about cities and countries he had never visited. It is a repository of wonderful stories, Mr. Bale concedes, though they defy credulity. The main place from which he departed, Mr. Bale observes of Mandeville, was the realm of truth. The Securities and Exchange Commission is watching you. This is by William Barr, a distinguished fellow at the Hudson Institute and author of his memoir, One Damn Thing After Another. He served as U.S. Attorney General from 91 to 93 and from 2019 to 20. The Securities and Exchange Commission is deploying a massive government database, the Consolidated Audit Trail, or CAT, C-A-T, that monitors in real time the identity, transactions, and investment portfolio of everyone who invests in the stock market. As SEC Commissioner Hester Pierce describes it, by allowing the commission to watch investors' every move in real time, CAT will make it easier to investigate insider trading or market manipulation. But as a lawsuit being filed Tuesday in Texas federal court makes clear, CAT crosses a constitutional red line. Accepting this sweeping surveillance would eviscerate fundamental privacy protections. That a few bad apples might engage in misconduct doesn't justify mass surveillance of everyone's private affairs. The SEC conceived of CAT during the Obama administration. Now, without congressional authorization and under the radar of most Americans, the commission is trying to impose it by executive fiat. CAT will reportedly be the single largest government database targeting the private activities of American citizens. The SEC can deal with potential market manipulation by focusing on the transactions of large institutional firms without sweeping up data on millions of small retail investors. Nevertheless, the agency is requiring every broker to feed into CAT in real time every securities transaction along with every investor's personal information, including name, address, and birth year. With a keystroke, more than 3,000 government employees and contractors from the SEC and more than 20 other regulatory bodies will be able to see the personal investment activities of tens of millions of Americans. This invites abusive investigatory fishing expeditions, targeting of individuals, and intrusive data mining. Concentrating this sensitive data in a single repository guarantees it inevitably will be hacked, stolen, or misused by bad actors, including hostile nations, cyber criminals, and faithless government employees. The Constitution prohibits mass surveillance of private activities based merely on the possibility that someone might commit a crime. The Fourth Amendment requires that before the government can access a person's home, papers, or personal effects, it must get a warrant showing probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and that the information will yield evidence of that crime. Even when the government seeks information about a citizen from banks, phone companies, and others with whom he's done business, the government isn't free to vacuum this up carte blanche. It must normally show that it's investigating specific suspected wrongdoing and that the information sought is potentially relevant to that particular inquiry. The Supreme Court has held that even access to some third-party information may require a warrant. In Carpenter v. U.S. 2018, the government obtained several months of cell tower data from a suspect's phone provider. The Supreme Court held that even though these were third-party records, a warrant was required because the data provided an exhaustive chronicle of the suspect's whereabouts over a 127-day period. The CAT program clearly violates these limits by collecting private information on tens of millions of investors without any connection to suspected wrongdoing, either by the investor or anyone else. By requiring that this information be continuously fed into the government's database, it gives the government a truly exhaustive chronicle of all investors' activities, not only their past activities, but their every move in real time. There are more targeted ways for the SEC to get what it needs. The SEC acknowledges that when a suspected violation occurs, it has the ability without CAT to gather the relevant evidence by issuing blue sheets, which require broker-dealers to provide information on the transactions and investors in a particular case. As one SEC commissioner observed, the SEC's enforcement program already performs very well without CAT and has sufficient tools to get the information it needs to pursue credible leads about market misconduct and to do so quickly. The crux of the SEC's argument is that it could investigate things more easily if it weren't limited to gathering investor information on a case-by-case basis after suspected wrongdoing took place. It could more quickly initiate investigations and more promptly take appropriate enforcement action. If it had immediate access to the entire universe of private investor information in real time. But the whole point of the Fourth Amendment is to make the government less efficient by making it jump through hoops when it seeks to delve into private affairs. For an agency to argue that it should be able to avoid these hoops to make investigations easier is to assert that it should be exempt from the Fourth Amendment. If our society accepts the SEC's rationale for CAT, there's no reason to confine the government to databases on investment activities. Digital records on a range of personal activity can help crack criminal cases. Phone companies have data from our smartphones. Automakers have data from our cars and so forth. Why not maximize the efficiency of all law enforcement by pumping this information into government databases so investigators have it in real time? CAT's sweep is unprecedented and would take us far down the road toward an Orwellian surveillance state. As the Supreme Court has reminded us, privacy comes at a cost. The cost is that law enforcement must sometimes be a little less efficient than it would be if Americans had no privacy. If there are shortcomings, improvements can be achieved by incremental fixes rather than by bulldozing American liberties. In October, disinformation surprise is coming. This is Business World by Holman W. Jenkins, Jr. Two of the most interesting things ever to happen in American politics happened in the past few years. A Democratic presidential campaign representing the incumbent party fabricated evidence that its Republican opponent and the eventual president-elect was a Russian agent, and the in-power party's FBI legitimated the evidence in the eyes of the media so it would be widely reported and believed by the public. To make sure it was believed, top intelligence officials of the outgoing administration went on cable television to call the new president a Russian mole and Vladimir Putin his case officer. When the formerly incumbent party's candidate was seeking to reclaim the White House 4 years later, the same former officials concocted a new lie to cover up embarrassing information about the candidate's family. These highly connected former officials had 5 days to check things out before claiming Hunter Biden's laptop had, quote, the classic earmarks of a Russian information operation. The New York Post included a receipt showing the FBI had already been in possession of the data for 10 months. Its story documented how the Post acquired the same data. Specific, dated, and verifiable events and messages weren't denied by the Bidens, etc. Obama intelligence officials James Clapper and John Brennan and their 49 colleagues lie today when they say they weren't lying then. These realities have been acknowledged on these pages and a few other papers around the country, on Fox News and at some partisan websites. They might as well never have happened as far as most of the press is concerned. New York Times resident chin-stroker Thomas Edsel, in the Trump era, has devoted 380 articles, many of them 3,000 words or longer, to raking over voter surveys and long quotes from political scientists psychoanalyzing the U.S. electorate. Not one examined the effect of these glaring events on voters or even acknowledged that they happened. Democratic and anti-Trump Republican political spinmeisters, from David Axelrod to Mike Murphy to Bill Kristol, spend hours a week on TV and in podcasts holding forth on politics, talking endlessly about Donald Trump, yet leave the collusion episodes unanalyzed as if they never occurred. After years, the press finally acknowledges that pollsters find Trump voters every bit as concerned about democracy as Biden voters. The two men are essentially tied on the issue of protecting democracy, with 43% of voters preferring Biden and 41% picking Trump, says NBC. Unasked is why. You might assume a utilitarian motive. Mr. Trump would benefit politically if the truth were acknowledged. Unless correlation has no relation to causation, unless participants in 1,000 focus groups are lying, the opposite is true. The dishonesty of his opponents remains Mr. Trump's great legitimizer, helping him pass January 6th and on the road to the White House again. The real motive for the press silence is fear and shame over acts that are close to treasonous. Mr. Trump's many demerits don't need to be enumerated here, but after 9 years, the tone of cable coverage has become more like primate gibbering than reasoned commentary. If it stops even for a moment, other truths might come up for air. Plainly false campaign memes, that he called neo-Nazis fine people, or that he advised drinking bleach, usually have their season and disappear. The anti-Trump tropes never get a day off, constantly dunning viewers with Mr. Trump's unique iniquity as if to rationalize his enemies' behavior. If the simple truth were admitted, Hillary Clinton would be a pariah. Adam Schiff would never appear on another ballot again. I'm not forgetting the complicity of the press, whose normal role is to take an interest in matters that are, you know, interesting. If it's true that cowards die 1,000 deaths, our media will bankrupt the Fisk with all the end-of-life care it's going to consume. Mr. Trump turns out to be less of a danger to our institutions than they are to themselves. Worry about a future leader with President Obama's gifts, not Donald Trump's, while remembering that the collusion hoaxes were promoted by official U.S. agencies in exactly the manner of Mr. Putin's Russia. All this is possibly going to matter a great deal this fall. Mr. Trump will tell his lies and tall tales and make his fabulous claims, and the media will have to deal with it. There's also a significant likelihood that 2024 will see lies manufactured by agents and veterans of the national security state. As in 2016 and 2020, then the press will get a third opportunity. These reporters and editors who are still capable of participating in the media business in good faith need to start thinking now about how they will deal with this if it happens again. Whatever happened to Gavin Newsom? This is by Ken Katchigian, who was a chief speechwriter to Ronald Reagan and the author of the forthcoming memoir, Behind Closed Doors, In the Room with Reagan and Nixon. Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? If Simon and Garfunkel were political pundits, they might ask, where have you gone, Gavin Newsom? When Joe Biden's stumbling, mumbling fortunes seemed to slip away, the left crowned Mr. Newsom as the obvious heir to the throne. It was near impossible to click on a link or touch the remote without seeing him romp across America, preaching California's acceptance of abortion, or flying off to China to shake hands with Xi Jinping. But Mr. Newsom never knew where to draw the line on primping. When he hired a portrait photographer to accompany him to China and take pictures of him at the Great Wall, even the left-leaning Politico magazine couldn't refrain from lampooning his portrait, so he attempted to look presidential at a faux Asian summit. The staged visit exposed the governor's most fatal political flaw, his lack of authenticity. That phony factor is one he can't escape and was summarized in a recent expose by the nonprofit news organization CalMatters. Governor Newsom has long touted his baseball career, including that he played at Santa Clara University, but he was never on the roster. Among other misperceptions of his accomplishments, Newsom hasn't corrected his record. Embellishments like that, along with more serious ones, such as traveling to Florida to claim that the Golden State is a low-tax paradise, are the type of political fumbles that have upended Mr. Newsom's hopes for higher office. But those misadventures are peanuts compared with the damage from his governing policies, which fracture the finances and stability of California. The fanciful bullet train project he inherited from his predecessors is now an anchor around Mr. Newsom's neck, as it has grown from its initially budgeted $33 billion in 2008 to upward of $100 billion just for the starter line because of overspending and mismanagement. Mr. Newsom's current statewide budget shortfall ranges from his wishful thinking $38 billion to a more realistic $73 billion, and the state auditor reports that California didn't sufficiently track outcomes of nearly $24 billion spent on homelessness in the last five fiscal years. Statewide polls by the Institute of Intergovernmental Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, show the governor's approval ratings are south of 50%, and nearly 6 out of 10 Californians believe the state is headed in the wrong direction. His political reputation was put to the test on the March ballot, where he pushed forward a $6 billion bond measure for more homeless spending. The measure passed by a margin of less than 0.5% of the vote. The governor, a San Francisco elitist groomed by Willie Brown and Nancy Pelosi for stardom, is flatlining. Despite Mr. Biden's baggage of high inflation, open borders, and tongue-twisting, the president has a second wind as his opponent is stuck in an unfavorable courtroom while the president is free to campaign, appearing statesmanlike amid international hostilities. Hence, liberal media and congressional loyalists are embracing Mr. Biden as the comeback kid. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd recently asked Democratic political consultant James Carville to name the party's promising new talents. Among governors, Mr. Carville listed North Carolina Roy Cooper, Michigan's Gretchen Whitmer, Kentucky's Andy Beshear, Maryland's Wes Moore, and Pennsylvania's Josh Shapiro. Notice anyone missing? Mr. Newsom was never as formidable as his fan base thought. Susan Shelley, an editorial writer for the Southern California News Group, shrewdly analyzed Newsom's lopsided victory against a recall attempt in 2021 by pointing out that recall targets are exempt from campaign contribution limits. This allowed Mr. Newsom to raise more than $70 million against underfunded opponents at a time when he still had emergency powers to close much of the economy. In his regularly scheduled 2022 reelection, Mr. Newsom fared worse against an obscure state senator, whom he outspent by a margin of 10-1, than he had 4 years earlier against a well-financed opponent. A well-funded opponent with name recognition could have beaten Mr. Newsom. Politicians come in flavors that fade. Beto O'Rourke and Stacey Abrams were the Democratic Party's flavors during the past decade. You'll be forgiven for not recalling their names. Mr. Newsom is the Democratic Party's most recent flavor, but his taste is rapidly fading. And that's it for this hour. Thank you so much for listening. This is Marta Bowling. You've been listening to an hour of Wall Street Journal editorials for the week ended Saturday, April 7th. Have a great rest of the weekend.